Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Rape is rape is rape, said Vice President Joe Biden last week at the University of New Hampshire. And the sooner universities make that clear, he said, the sooner we'll begin to make progress on campuses. In the same week, the U.S. Department of Education sent new guidance to colleges across the country, urging a stronger response to what a Title IX complaint out of Yale calls a hostile sexual environment. This hour on Point, what's going on with sex on the American college campus? You can join the conversation. Have you seen a culture of complacency when it comes to sexual assault on college campuses, a hostile sexual environment? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It is a tough topic we are picking up today, listeners. Please be aware it may bring us to language in this show that some people may find objectionable. Joining me first today is Preska Ahn. She graduated from Yale University in 2010, last year. She was founding editor there of the feminist magazine, Broad Recognition. She's now a Fulbright Scholar at the London School of Economics and one of the 16 Yale students and alums who this spring filed a formal Title IX complaint against the university. Preska Ahn, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What's the complaint?
The complaint that we filed in March is a 26-page document, and essentially it outlines two distinct but related patterns that we've been finding at Yale. These are students and recent alumni who signed the complaint. And one of the things that we point out in the report that we gave is a kind of continued institutional tolerance to very public acts of sexual misconduct. And the second thing is the university's own sort of flawed disciplinary procedure for dealing with cases of sexual assault.
You're talking about public acts of sexual misconduct. So that doesn't sound like date rape. That's usually private. What are you talking about then?
So there are two different things. We're talking about how Yale deals with sexual assault in disciplinary procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is saying that the hostile environment at the school is also contributed to by Yale's response to things like fraternities chanting violently on the quad where freshman women live, sort of anti-woman chants, things of this nature, and that Yale's inability or unwillingness to discipline people, students who act this way, is contributing to a general atmosphere where women's concerns are being subordinated to other students.
Now, Title IX, of course, is the big legislation from way back that requires equality in treatment on campus. A formal Title IX complaint is a pretty serious step. What drove you and the group with you, Preska Ahn, to take this step? What extremity?
I think it's been an escalating issue on campus. Every year that I was a student at Yale, there was a prominent incident of sort of acts that were violent towards or harassing women, and there were also a number of private complaints of sexual assault that weren't dealt with appropriately, the people who brought these complaints felt. And there have been efforts by students and faculty to ask Yale to intervene, but unfortunately, whether out of unwillingness or out of an inability to imagine better options, the university's preferred way of dealing with things like this is to create a new report or generate a new committee about it and promise to review it in a year or 2 years. And this, Yale's slowness to act and its inability to kind of discipline right away people who do things that are so disrespectful to the community has led the students at Yale and its recent alumni to feel, well, we don't have really any other options. We've petitioned Yale and asked them to do things about this issue, but they've been very, very slow and unresponsive. And so it was felt that this complaint would encourage the school to move a little faster and more decisively on this problem.
Preska, how widespread is your sense of this concern on this one campus? We'll look across the country. Here you were founding editor of a feminist magazine. You might be at the forefront. You might be more sensitive or less willing to, you know, deal with unprettiness on this front. Is this a widespread perception?
I think the perception that Yale is acting adequately is, I think, pretty widespread. There was a huge petition earlier this year in response to one of the recent events in which members of the fraternity Deke shouted, you know, very explicit and violent chants on campus on the freshman quad.
No means yes, and worse, right. they were chanting.
You know, I think, yeah, I'm not sure you can say the whole thing on
mm-hmm.
public radio,
mm-hmm.
But it's really terrible stuff. And there was a public outcry from among alumni, parents, students, and I think that was part of the reason that Yale tried to come out, you know, issuing some PR statements saying that, oh, you know, they didn't condone this kind of action. But, you know, we don't have any real outcome from that. I mean, what Yale has done is organize a conversation on campus to generally discuss Yale's, like, quote, sexual climate, which really isn't the issue. I mean, it is part of the issue that we should discuss these issues of sexual safety as a community. But I think the important thing is that the school send a strong message to say, well, look, when you're a student and you threaten other students with this kind of abusive speech, then you sort of forfeit your right to be a member of this community. And Yale hasn't done that. The people who did those terrible things are still walking around in classes and mingling with the women who are the targets of their chants. And I think that's inappropriate.
Your complaint there is about a public display of acute misogyny, maybe. What about the private side of this? Are you,
yeah.
When you say hostile sexual environment, does that extend to, I don't know, sexual assault and the rest?
It absolutely does, and it relates in two ways. One is that when the university, over the course of a few years, sends the message that it won't discipline people who are sexually violent in the session or who are harassing other students on the basis of gender, then it sends a message that's acceptable behavior. And it makes it much less likely that women will feel like their concerns will be taken seriously if they bring a complaint to Yale's disciplinary board. And then if you look at Yale's own disciplinary procedures themselves, I think they're also, I mean, they're confidential, which is in the university's interest and sometimes in the interest of people who are involved. But what you hear, like, for example, in our complaint, we also, in addition to talking about Yale's general attitude, included testimonies of people who had felt that Yale's disciplinary procedure had failed them in a particularly egregious way. One of these cases involved an undergrad who brought a complaint of sexual assault to the school because the school encouraged people not to go to the hospital or to the police or to Connecticut law, but to go through the school's private channels to deal with these things. And the student was discouraged by this disciplinary board from going to the police or going even to a higher level of Yale's own disciplinary structure, the executive committee. And so she felt there was just no support for her to take that to the next level and sort of say, well, this student has done this thing to me. She was actively discouraged from going forward with her complaint. And sexual assault is a crime. And it's shocking to me that members of the school who are supposed to deal with these issues would discourage a student from trying to seek recourse and redress.
Priska, you've already, in response to your complaint, it would appear, had this big, big letter, dear colleague letter from the Department of Education to universities across the country, basically saying, come on, toughen up, here's the law, we're giving you sterner guidance on this front, and people will pay attention because there are a lot of dollars attached to Title IX. Do you think you've already succeeded at some level, or what's your ultimate aim here?
Well, I will say that it was really heartening to hear Vice President Joe Biden and Arne Duncan's about that campaign to raise awareness about Title IX and their belief that there is a real link between, you know, issues of sexual safety on campuses and equal educational access. But it wasn't in response to our complaint that they began that campaign. The Department of Education is saying it's coincidental. And really, what we're just Yale students, and we can only speak to our school. Like, I know that this is an issue on campuses across the country and schools and universities. And there, you know, the Department of Justice projects there'll be 92 sexual assaults every year on campus, this kind of thing. And it's a nationwide problem. But we can only speak as students with a specific experience of a specific school. And so I don't think we're going to feel that some progress has been made until Yale acknowledges that perhaps its process for dealing with these issues may have been a bit flawed in the past, and that there is a way to go forward from that, to reform its procedures and to, you know, promote a better environment on campus for women.
Priska Ann, Yale alum now, one of the signatories of the formal complaint, Title IX complaint, about what they call a hostile sexual environment at Yale University. Priska, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks, Tom.
Here's a little sound of Vice President Joe Biden at the University of New Hampshire last week announcing new federal guidance on fighting sexual assault on college campuses.
Look, guys, no matter what a girl does, no matter how she's dressed, no matter how much she's had to drink, it's never, 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 never okay to touch her without her consent. This doesn't make you a man. It makes you a coward.
It makes you a coward. The vice president there picking up the issue last week in New Hampshire. Joining us right now from Lexington, Kentucky is Dorothy Edwards. She's executive director of Green Dot. It's a nonprofit dedicated to intervention and prevention of personal violence. She founded the University of Kentucky's Violence Intervention and Prevention Center. She's author of Green Dot Violence Prevention Strategy. Dorothy Edwards, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Tom.
We've just got a minute before the break, but here's Yale with a big problem on its hands with this Title IX complaint. How widespread is this kind of problem? This characterization, a hostile sexual environment, does that sound like one of a kind at one campus to you, or a wider problem in this country?
No, of course it's a wider problem. There are reliable data from across years and years and years that tell us women on college campuses face a disproportionately high risk of sexual assault. And when you're talking consistently about numbers like 1 in 4, 1 in 5 women will face a actual or attempted rape, there's not a question of, is this a hostile environment? Of course it is. The question is, how do we do better, not only as universities, but as the communities that surround these universities, not only as students, but as administrators, how do we do better at addressing this really urgent issue?
Is it an eternal hostility, the battle of the sexes, or something new, different, worse happening here, Dorothy?
I don't think it's new. I don't think it's new, different, worse. I think it's been relatively consistent, and that's worth understanding as well. Why has it maintained for so long?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about a hostile sexual environment and the American college campus. A formal Title IX complaint out of Yale, but it's not the only place. Here's the sound of a protest just last month at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. Students marching to protest how that school manages cases of sexual assault. Our rights, our campus, our rights, our bodies. Last month, 16 Yale University students and alum filed a Title IX complaint with the Department of Education. Here's Hannah Zeven, a junior at Yale, one of the signatories of the complaint.
In giving the example of how people at Yale don't know all their options and not a single person is expelled for the crime of rape, that's hostile because it creates an environment in which such crimes are tolerated by virtue of the fact that they're not being punished. And that's what must really change.
Vice President Joe Biden has taken up the issue. He spoke last week at the University of New Hampshire, saying when it comes to sexual abuse, aggression, the boundaries are clear.
No means no. No means no if you're drunk or you're sober. No means no if you're in bed, in a dorm, or on the street. No means no, even if you said yes at first and you change your mind. No means no.
And then this, in New Hampshire, from the Vice President of the United States.
Rape is rape is rape. And the sooner universities make that clear, the sooner we'll begin to make progress on campuses.
Dorothy Edwards joins us from Lexington, Kentucky. She founded the University of Kentucky's Violence Intervention and Prevention Center. She's executive director of Green Dot, which works on issues of prevention of personal violence. And Dorothy, this is very tough language from the vice president. Were you surprised at it? Is there a problem worthy of that sort of prominence, the vice president reminding the country, college students he was talking to, rape is rape is rape? Does that sound welcome, necessary to you?
Absolutely necessary. Not surprised in that it was coming from Vice President Biden, who has always been such a strong voice around this issue. But, the questions of, is this a problem? And the fact that this issue is still seen as kind of controversial and a hot button issue when what we're talking about is among, the most violent crimes that can be committed mm-hmm. against an individual. And the fact that it's still considered controversial, the fact that there's the sense of kind of resigned inevitability that, just part of the college experience is, numbers like 1 in 4, 1 in 5. That's where we've kind of lost our way. We've got to step back and go, just that we're asking the question is skewed. One in five of our daughters are going to be sexually assaulted on their way to their bachelor's degree. That is alarming, and it needs to alarm us again as a nation.
If that's not a hot button, I don't know what it is, just on its own merits, as you say. But what's the problem? What's the systemic problem? Is there really a ton of rape going on American campuses? And if there is, wouldn't that call for a really tough response? And if it's not there, why not, Dorothy?
Yeah, there is indeed. The numbers really can't be credibly questioned. There's been so many studies. So there is indeed. What we know, though, from some research by folks like David Lisak and others, it's actually quite a small number of people that are committing this violence. It's a small number that are committing the crimes over and over and over again. So the vast majority of men and women are not committing this violence. And so the issue becomes, how do we identify and hold accountable those men? And what we want to do, instead of looking at our college young men, the small number, and saying out loud, gosh, we have a serial offender, a serial predator on our campus. What we want to do is go, oh gosh, that's not one of our students. This is just an honest misunderstanding. Oh gosh, they both had so much to drink, and it was just a miscommunication. And boy, we don't want to ruin his life over this. So number one, I think, is our reluctance to say, you know, in fact, there are some dangerous repeat offenders on our college campuses. Number two is kind of the age old universities don't want to deal with the negative press associated with acknowledging that sexual assault happens on their campus. Mm-hmm. But it's time to work past that. You know, it's all universities. There's no one immune. And if I'm going to send my kid to a college, I'm going to send my kid to a college where they will say out loud, yes, this issue happens here. Not one that in 2011 is still trying to say, oh, no, that's not an issue on our campus.
Let me get a caller or two in here. Holly from Portland, Maine is on the line. Holly, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What have you seen, Holly?
Hi, Tom. I agree with everything that's being said, but I think that the substance abuse issue is just as large and has to be discussed alongside this. It's really about kids getting totally out of control and because of substances and the binging that's going on, and that's a huge issue on campus.
Are you talking about drinking first and foremost, Holly, or?
Both. All substances.
Yep, yep.
Substance abuse, drugs and drinking.
Ali, I appreciate your call. Dorothy, is that the typical setting for this kind of problem? Is it at all murky because it may be bound up with big drinking or other substance abuse on campus?
Again, there's a lot of misunderstanding around the relationship between alcohol and sexual assault. Are there a significant number of sexual assaults that involve alcohol? There are. But there's not a causality. It's not because someone drank, they got assaulted. What happens is alcohol is used as a tool, is used as a weapon by perpetrators. If I get my victim drunk, a couple of things happen. Number one is she is less able to resist. She's less able to kind of see the cues of potential danger, and I've got an easier target. Number two, what happens is as soon as alcohol is put into the mix, and the perpetrators know this, mm-hmm. as soon as alcohol is put into the mix, what happens is the surrounding community, we start going, well, she was drinking. Well, what did she think was happening? Well, what's happening with this underage? Who gave him that alcohol to begin with? And we completely forget about the perpetrator that's likely on their fourth or fifth rape. So it's almost if I'm a perpetrator and I use alcohol as one of my weapons, I'm almost guaranteed I get to walk free.
Wow, you're talking about serial rapists, as you describe it, on college campuses. Joe Biden talked about this whole issue of drinking as well in New Hampshire last week, talking with about 600 students there, told the story of an anonymous college freshman he called Jenny, who he said never got justice after she was raped by another student.
The student judicial panel said that they didn't find Jenny credible because she had been drinking. They decided her rapist was a nice kid and didn't deserve the punishment under the circumstances.
Under the circumstances. You can look around. Here's earlier this month at American University, students demanded more education on campus about sexual assault. Here's one student's testimony there.
I'm a student at AU, and last year I came really close to being a part of the statistic that says that in 2008, 200 women on our campus were raped within just that year. I was in the room of another student on this campus who assumed that by consenting to some sexual acts, I was consenting to all sexual acts.
By consenting to some, consenting to all is not so, the vice president says. Chris in West Hartford, Connecticut. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm an old Yalie myself. I'm not really old. I guess I'm in my 40s. I've still got lots of life in me.
Okay, good.
Anyway, back in the 80s, the problem, the sexual climate problem, was just the fact of AIDS. You know, everybody was scared of anything having to do with it. There was misbehavior back then, and there remains, I think, misbehavior on campus, which is associated around privileged groups. One is athletes, and one is maybe wealthier kids who come from privileged families, you know, whether they're from legacy families or whether they just have to be from powerful families. And I think that I smelled in some of what your first guest was talking about, a pattern of maybe a reluctance on the part of the university to punish kids who come from certain privileged classes. Now, I want to say, very importantly here, I knew lots of people as an undergrad and had lots of friends, and almost everyone was, you know, in speaking in old-fashioned terms, a gentleman. Almost all my friends would never hurt, you know, a female friend of theirs. But there were, you know, some cases, and then you get kids together, like with these Deke protests or whatever they were, where kids get together in a pack and maybe egged on by a couple of bad apples, behave badly as a group. We've seen that in other contexts.
Right, but you raised this issue of privilege, Chris, and I want to go to that if I may. Dorothy, what about it? Is it a privileged class that feels exempt somehow at college, or does this extend beyond some kind of realm of privilege?
I think it extends. I'm not saying that wouldn't be a component of it. But it goes beyond that. If we look at the research, it's not limited to that. It's not limited to that group.
I want to expand our consideration of what's going on here a little bit. There's Dorothy, you're pointing at discipline that happens and does not happen very often in these cases. Many complaints about how light the discipline can be. You're talking about students who may have done this four or five times in their college career, and the vulnerability of female students in particular on college campuses as a result. I want to think a little bit about the broader cultural context. Joining me right now in the studio is Gail Dines. She's a professor of sociology and women's studies, chair of the American Studies Department at Wheelock College. She's author of Porn Land, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality, out last year, out in paperback just this week. Gail Dines, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So we're being told this has been an issue on college campuses for a long time. We're seeing a lot of complaint about it right now. Dorothy says it's not exactly new, but it's worth looking at the cultural surround, the era in which these particular students have grown up, what they've seen, the expectations perhaps that have been built. When you look at these complaints coming off college campuses today, what about that bigger surround? What do you see there?
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate the women at Yale. I think this is wonderful, and I hope students all over the country now start doing this, because colleges have to start taking more responsibility. What I'm seeing, and I think many of us who are studying campuses and also studying sexual behaviour on campuses, is this is not new, but we're seeing an escalation and an intensification of kind of violent, verbally abusive, physically abusive behaviour. We're also seeing a change in the sexual dynamics on campus. Studies are showing there's very little dating going on now, and increasingly what's called hookup sex. And what's happening is
hookup sex rather than dating. And
yes.
Describe, young people will know exactly what that means, but describe the difference for people who have an older model in mind.
Okay, well, dating is where obviously you make some commitment that there's going to be a relationship. With hookup sex, the idea is, and it can go from anything from just a kiss right through to full sexual intercourse, but the issue of hookup sex is there's no expectation of anything outside of the sex. Now, what studies are showing are very interesting is that women are doing hookup sex in the hope that a relationship comes out of it. And when they interview men, they don't want a relationship, because their argument is, why should I when I can get all of this hookup sex? So what studies are finding is this dynamic has shifted from dating to hookup. We also know that women who do hookup have more depression, lower self-esteem, more likely to be into alcohol and drug abuse. So this is not working well for women.
Why the shift? I mean, the notion in the old days was that you had to kind of put some effort in here into a relationship before you'd get to sexuality. Why sex first?
Well, you have to look at what's going on in the culture. And let's think about this, what's really gone on. And in my book, Pornland, I talk about a porn culture. And what does that mean? So let's think about who some of these role models are now outside in the world. We've got people like Adam Sandler. We've got people like Howard Stern. We've got people like Owen Wilson. And what you're seeing increasingly is this kind of adolescent boy behaviour being used by men. So you've got Adam Sandler and these men who are in the 40s and are doing movies where they act like 15-year-old adolescent boys. And that means no commitment, just trying to get as much sex as they can from women, not basically manning up to what it means to become a more mature adult. What you also have is now the average male, his form of sex education comes from pornography. That is the leading form of sex education in our society today. Pornography is about telling men that they should have absolutely no commitment to women, that women do not exist as human beings outside, of course, of their sexual availability. And so what men are doing, the more pornography they're actually using, the more they're internalizing the pornographic messages about how to think and treat women. And when you look at what happened at Yale, when you look at one of the comments which you haven't had, which they said in Yale, they were chanting, yes means anal, right? The question is...
No means yes, yes means anal.
Yes means anal. Now, where does that come from? That comes straight from pornography. That is the major form of sex in pornography today. And anyone who studies pornography, when you hear that, you know exactly what these men are talking about. So what I'm really looking at, and what many of us who study college campuses, is how has the porn culture infiltrated male sexuality today?
You're saying we're raising, teaching men to be abusive in a sense.
That's what pornography is. Pornography is a manual on how to treat women as dehumanized sex objects. That's what pornography does best. And this is the kind of sex education most men are now internalizing.
Dorothy Edwards, do you buy that? You're listening there in Lexington, Kentucky. Does it seem to you, do you feel that kind of cultural force coming onto the campus in the minds of young American men when they're arriving?
I'm not an expert on pornography. Obviously, it's an influence, and obviously it is shaping. We have, not even at college, it's starting, unfortunately, with the internet and all the web-based stuff, pornographic imagery and languages. Our younger children, I mean, middle school, high school are being exposed to this kind of stuff and really losing, as been really alluded to, our young people are no longer following kind of a natural, developmentally appropriate development of sexuality. They're being exposed to these images earlier and earlier and earlier, and really beginning to behave in ways that they don't even completely understand.
Does that mean young women are up against something new when they encounter the sexual realm, and here's a young man who's raised in that milieu? Dorothy.
Yes, I think indeed they are faced with, and this idea of the mix that was alluded to, this idea of women are hoping to get a relationship and men are just hoping for the sex, you know, that's not new. That's been going on.
Yep.
But I think what the hooking up culture does is it serves as a really detrimental mask. It really helps hide sexual assault, because now you've got administrators and other peers and colleagues going, oh, well, you know, they were just hooking up. And now a perpetrator can be going, what? I just thought we were hooking up. So when you add alcohol now on top of this hooking up culture, again, we're creating a space where perpetrators are consistently getting off scot-free.
Gail Dines, when you start with hooking up, that's a tougher place to begin from to make the later discernment about what's happened here, I guess.
Well, actually,
or not.
No. I have to tell you, my students get raped in a hookup. We're not talking about she said no, he said yes. We're talking about, I've had students who've been choked to the point they pass out. I've had them beaten bloody.
Okay.
I mean, and we want to make this perfectly clear.
Pretty clear.
We have this image of date rape as, you know, it's not quite sure in the communication. No, these are perpetrators. The woman is saying no, she's crying, she's begging, and they're continuing. And the question is, and we have to ask this, we often say boys will be boys. Well, as a mother of a son, I refuse to accept that. My boy and your boys are not born with this desire to be perpetrators. So we need to look to the culture and asking what is shaping these men into being perpetrators.
Gail Dines, author of Pornland, please stand by. Dorothy Edwards in Lexington, Kentucky. We're talking about the hostile sexual environment in the American college campus. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about a hostile sexual environment and the American college campus. Title IX complaint out of Yale, a new guidance from the Department of Education, tough new guidance saying colleges, pull up your socks, be on top of this, pay close attention to it, and don't just roll over. But there is a feeling right across the land that there's too much rolling over going on. Here's students at American University staging a protest this month to get the school's administration there to take more active measures against sexual assault.
1, 2, 3, 4, we won't take it anymore. 5, 6, 7, 8, no more violence, no more hate. 1, 2, 3, 4.
We are listening this hour. Here's a Dickinson College student in Pennsylvania, interviewed by Pennsylvania's Fox 43.
I don't think they should be holding students accountable for getting rid of rapists on campus. That should be their job, not ours.
That should be the job of the university. But is it? Is it seen that way? And what's going on? And I should say again, just a warning here, there's some tough language and tough realities associated with this in this hour. If that's not for you, then be forewarned. We're joined in this hour by Dorothy Edwards from Lexington, Kentucky. She founded the University of Kentucky's Violence Intervention and Prevention Center. She's executive director of Green Dot, which works on these problems. And with me in the studio today, Gail Dines of Wheelock College. She's author of Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. It's out in paperback this week. Let's go to the phones. Annette in Youngstown, New York. Annette, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling in on a personal experience. In the late or early 90s, when I was in college in a freshman dorm, it was the policy back then for the RAs to have a master key to the girls, to everybody's room. So
these are the resident advisors, the upperclassmen who are supposed to be kind of keeping an eye on things?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And unfortunately, this RA had a little gathering in his area, and a bunch of us went. And apparently he had put a date rape drug in our drinks. They were not alcoholic drinks. It was not date rape.
Yep.
He was helping himself to our rooms with the master key. And when I went and I reported, I mean, obviously it was very traumatic, and I went and I reported, and as weeks went by, I found out that he had been doing this to other girls for about a month.
Annette, are you saying that you were molested, abused, raped? What?
I'm sorry, yes. I guess I skipped over that part. Yes, he helped himself to my room. He raped me later that night.
And what was the reaction, the response from the university when you raised this?
I went to the residence life director, who was above him, and she said, oh, my goodness, you know, what were the circumstances? And I said that I'd gone to a gathering. He had had a gathering in the wing of his hallway, and she said, you know, well, were you drinking? Was there alcohol? Were you part of this? Kind of like making it look like it was my fault. And I was embarrassed, you know, and I was shaky, of course. And it was a few weeks later that, I mean, as my parents came up and we were trying to, you know, sort this out, what is happening here,
mm-hmm.
I found from other girls in the building that had been happening to them as well. And the resident's life, he continued to have the master's key. They kind of poo-pooed it. It was the girls kind of, oh, there must have been something else.
Wow. Wow. So
it turned out, it was, and my parents went, they came up, they actually went to campus security with a freshman kind of orientation folder pretending that they were looking at the college. And they asked them, you know, how safe is this campus? You know, what's the rate of, you know, what's the rape? You know, what is the, I can't say, like the statistics.
Incidents,
you know,
or sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, no. Well, there was a few years ago that there was a girl that was raped and killed. That's true. But we don't really have that problem here. And my parents were like, interesting.
Meanwhile, it was happening to their own daughter, or it had happened. Annette, I appreciate your calling. I mean, Dorothy Edwards, that seems pretty incredible. If you've got an RA, they've got a key to everybody's room, the girls are taking it to the administration, and they're really not intervening. The RA goes right on with that key. Does that sound archaic, like that's the way it used to be, or is there still that kind of blind eye?
I want to touch on two things. One is, I wish I could act shocked right now. Like, mm-hmm. I wish I could be shocked. I'm horrified, but I'm not shocked. That kind of cover-up of what is, or dismissal of what is clearly extreme forms of violence is not uncommon. It's not uncommon. And the element of this conversation that I want to bring in that was mm-hmm. alluded to by Gail earlier is, you know, historically when we talk about this issue, we have talked about essentially like there are just two characters in the story, a potential perpetrator and a victim. And the fact is there is a third character, and that's this bystander. That's the surrounding community. And just as Gail kind of referenced, I refuse to kind of accept as inevitable that my son has some predisposition to being a perpetrator. We have to step back as a culture, as parents and the surrounding community, and go, have we just accepted as inevitable? Because, Tom, the reality is if 1 in 4, 1 in 5 laptops were stolen from a college campus, I can guarantee you there would be outrage. I can guarantee you parents would be calling going, my kid's computer was stolen. What's mm-hmm, going on? Mm-hmm. I can guarantee you the president and the police chief would do a joint press conference and say, we're getting to the bottom of
right.
this. But 1 in 4, 1 in 5 of our daughters are being raped. Where is the outcry? And what's our culpability in our kind of acquiescence, our kind of passive response to this that, in fact, emboldens administrations to sweep it under the rug?
You can say, I add something on
are,
this?
Are we complicit is the question you put out there, Dorothy. Gail, sorry.
Yeah, I'd like to add this as well about, let's taking off on what Dorothy's saying. If college campuses are serious about stopping violence against women, then they're going to have to do a lot more educational programs, and they're going to have to be a lot more strict on campus about what is allowed and isn't. For example, I hear all the time, and I'm going around the country at the moment talking about pornography and sexuality to students, and I've heard from thousands of students in the last 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And students tell me all the time, they go into the common areas and the men are watching pornography, they go into the men's rooms and they're watching violent pornography. And when I say, you know, have you talked to the college here? There's no protocol in place in any of these colleges. And pornography is a form of sexual harassment. It makes an unsafe environment for women. And I think
watching it in a common area where all students are circulating?
Absolutely, I hear this all the time. And really, and we're not talking Playboy or Penthouse. I know I can't describe on the air.
Rougher stuff than that. Talk about a green light. I mean, if you accept that, then, I mean,
and they're laughing at it. And so I think colleges, when they do their anti-violence programs, which mm-hmm. some of them are really a lot better at now, they're doing these in the freshman week, they really need to start doing anti-pornography programs as well. They need to start talking to these young men, many of whom's only contact with sex has been through pornography. And I'm not exaggerating there. That was their first introduction mm-hmm. to sex at 11.5 years of age, which is the first time most men have
right
boys
off the
are
web,
doing pornography.
Very likely.
Mm-hmm. Then they sort of use that as they get older. So by the time they come to college at 18, their sexuality has been formed through the porn industry. They need to hear about how they have learned to see women in certain ways, how this has shaped their sexuality, and how this is basically undermining equality on college campuses.
I mean, in a way, for their own good, for their own
Absolutely.
Mental sexual health.
I can't tell you the stories I hear from men telling me, literally coming to me after I've given a lecture, in tears saying, help me. I hear this all the time though. Help me. I've started using pornography when I was young. I can't believe the stuff I'm using now. I'm horrified. I'm disgusted with myself.
Let's go to Mike in Cheshire, Connecticut. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to touch on what was just said real quick. That was a very good point, and I think a lot of guys who go to colleges in America right now just don't have any sense of chivalry anymore. There's no the sense of being a gentleman these days is kind of out the window.
Mind chivalry, just a kind of a healthy, respectful appreciation of sexuality that's not porn-based, let's say. But what's your experience, Mike? What's your story?
I've got quite a story, and it would take way too long to put in the air right now. But I wanted to sort of go into sort of alcohol and consent. A lot of I've heard a couple
yep.
people talk about how men use alcohol to try to forced consent on women. And I think, especially in colleges these days, people go out to these parties with the intention of meeting someone and I'm saying guys and girls alike,
okay.
not just guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go out, they'll drink, they'll have a good time, and the problem really arises where, and I think a lot of men forget this, but when a girl drinks, it doesn't matter how much she's had, she cannot legally consent. It doesn't matter. And I heard someone say before, you know, you don't have to worry about how much she drinks. That's exactly what you have to worry about. Because she can go ahead and still give permission. But that said, it doesn't matter. Once she's had that single sip, if she regrets it in the morning, she has every right to bring it up. And I think that's why a lot of this sort of gray area comes up, why a lot of things don't get reported, why things don't always get acted upon by these universities, is because many of the times, and not all, clearly not all, but many of the times, these girls are just simply regretting some poor decision. And where
are you saying you were accused of rape, Mike?
At one point, absolutely. But I think, you know, you have to keep in mind, I've dealt with my stuff, and I've brought up all my evidence and everything else. And everything that happened with me has been wiped. Everything that I had was cleared.
When you look back on it, do you feel that you were, in that instance, a rapist?
Absolutely not. And I think most of these guys don't think that. And then again, I also witness many people on many campuses who habitually go out to bars looking to meet girls with the intent of date raping. And that's actually their end goal.
And you say you were cleared. That means your college cleared you of this? Is that what that means, Mike?
Yes. So my college never actually went through with anything on this.
Yeah.
That said, there was also claims of mind-washing, this, that, and the other once all the evidence came out. Basically, all the stories were changed around. So you have to keep in mind sort of the context of my situation.
Mike, stick with us for a second here, if you would, Mike. Dorothy, come in here. You've got experience. Here's Mike. We're on the phone. We just met. We don't know. But you hear the story he's telling, and he's conveying a kind of confusing grayness here. Now, earlier we heard stark rejections of that grayness, as justified. But what about it? You're hearing it direct from the young man.
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about this. The notion of regretted sex, which essentially accounts to false reporting, is on the
let's say woman's part, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
On the potential victim, the notion that I woke up, I regretted it. This false report is simply untrue. It's not. It doesn't. I'm not saying it never happens, but what we're finding from credible studies is somewhere between 2 and 8%, 6% is often cited, sexual assaults are false reports, which is right in line with false reports of other major crimes. On the other hand, what we also know is very few women who are victims ever report at all. And so what we know is it's far more likely that women have been raped and not told anyone, then a woman wasn't raped and made it up. And so that's the first. And yet that idea of regretted sex or false report gets such a disproportionate amount of attention. That's the first piece of misinformation. The second piece of misinformation that I think college officials deal with a lot is this idea of this gray fuzzy thing. This idea of, oh gosh, well-intentioned guys that had an honest misunderstanding, an honest miscommunication. One study, again, out of Boston, in fact, David Lisek, found that up to 90% of sexual assaults committed on a college campus are committed by repeat offenders.
So what does that mean? Should it go straight to the police? Never mind these kind of, cozy, quiet university disciplinary boards. Is that what you're suggesting, Dorothy? Just make it criminal?
I think it is criminal.
Treat it criminally, excuse me?
Yes, I would advocate both and. I think it should be treated criminally because it's a criminal matter. And I think universities are charged with maintaining a safe environment for everyone. So I think also it should be handled through the disciplinary process. But I don't think ever sexual assault should be approached as a, oops, well-intentioned, let's have a teachable moment here. We're talking about a violent crime.
Mike, I appreciate your call. I appreciate you. Yes, Mike, sorry?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with that, but I also want to throw out as just something to sort of, keep in the back of your mind. And I know in my case, when everything sort of got put down, nothing ever went back to the girl who made the false accusation in the first place, which, I think it needs to be, all of it needs to be treated equally, all of it needs to be treated seriously. But more importantly, whenever someone goes ahead and has anything like this happen with them, and I agree that repeat offenders should, I think everyone should sort of have an analysis, a psychological analysis on them to prove one way or the other, where exactly they stand on this and whether or not they really are a threat.
I think psychological analysis is not going to do it for Dorothy Edwards. Gail, how do we move beyond this?
Well, can I just say what's happening to women here? I think we're setting our young women up because we're giving them hypersexualized images of themselves. We're telling them, to wear the thong sticking out, the tramp stamp, the low slung jeans, the high heels, the pierced belly button. We're telling them to look hypersexualized. Then they dress hypersexualized because there's no alternative if you want to be visible in this culture, because the alternative to looking like that is to be invisible. So then we make them highly visible as hypersexualized objects. They go out, they hook up with these guys, they get raped, and then when they get raped and they say, well, look, they say, hey, look what you were dressed like, look what you're behaving like. When what we have done to these young women is we have told them this is the only way to be seen and visible in this culture, this is the only way to get male attraction, and then, or to get males to look at you, is to look hot. And then, should they get raped, we slam them with that image. It's not as if we have a multiple ways of being female in this culture. We have literally closed down alternative ways of being female other than the Lady Gaga, Miley Cyrus, Britney Spears.
This
look.
Kind of gets into the community complicity, or at least media
totally.
Complicity.
We have a society complicit in setting up our young women, in socializing our young boys into doing pornography. We then throw alcohol in the mix. We tell girls they should hook up. They go and do this. They get into unsafe situations, not of their own making. And then when anything happens, we either tell them to shut up or we accuse them of being sluts.
Here's an online comment from Diana. She says, the problem isn't just rape. The hostile sexual environment, Diana writes, contains implicit pressure or approval for women to participate in consensual sex throughout young adulthood, combined with substance abuse. In many cases, there's never a no means no, she writes, just two drunk kids, one who wakes up with regret and guilt, and the other who wakes up to high fives. I mean, this is hardly the picture that we want to have on our campuses. Dorothy, do you feel, I mean, the Department of Education is pushing right now for people to become more strict on this. Can it be fixed at that point? Is that the place, Dorothy?
I think it's got to be a multi-pronged strategy. I mean, anything that's as widespread as this has got to be conceptualized as a public health issue. And the public health model says not only do we have to be dealing with it at the enforcement level, but as Gail referred to, we also have to be right at the front end dealing with education and making sure our young men and women understand their role as bystanders and responsible members of the community.
Right, it's a tough issue, but I'm glad to see it confronted. I'm glad to confront it with the two of you today. Dorothy Edwards, in Lexington, Kentucky, founder of the University of Kentucky's Violence Intervention and Prevention Center, executive director of Green Dot. Dorothy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you so much, Gail.
And Gail Dines, a Wheelock College author of Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. Gail Dines, thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you very much.
Listeners, thanks for your calls and insights today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.